Excellent. Morning, everyone here. Good afternoon, everyone at the IASB. We have one topic for discussion today, and that is our joint project on financial instruments, classification and management. And I understand that Yulia is going to start us off this morning, this after today.
Kirsten will introduce the agenda items.
Thanks, Yulia. So as she mentioned, I'm teeing up the first paper, which is Agenda Paper 6A. And this paper summarizes our feedback we received from users of financial statements on our proposed limited amendments to the classification measurement requirements in IFRS 9. So the staff have had a substantial number of consultations with users and through comment letters, outreach meetings, and also a survey that had feedback from over 60 user groups and individual users as well, covering various backgrounds and jurisdictions. And this feedback and outreach focused on the proposed introduction of fair value OCI measurement category and included feedback with insurance analysts and also some joint outreach as well. Although we focused on the fair value through OCI measurement category, our outreach also asked for users' views on the own credit requirements and the early application of those. And we also welcomed additional feedback that they had. So the feedback received by the FASB on their proposed ASU will be addressed in more detail by Shaw when he tees up his paper, Agenda Paper 6B. So our feedback discussion will focus first just on what we received from the ISB perspective. Moving on, I'll tee up the main topic in this paper, which is the feedback we received on fair value OCI, paragraphs 13 through 34 in the paper. As you'll see in the paper, most users supported measuring some simple debt instruments at fair value OCI. And they also didn't make a distinction based on the legal form of the instrument, so debt investments versus loans and receivables. Their views were split pretty evenly in three broad groups. Firstly, those being those who supported fully fair value OCI as proposed in our exposure draft. Secondly, those that supported classifying some simple debt investments at fair value OCI, but they supported it with a difference from our proposals. And thirdly, there were those that disagreed with introducing a third measurement category into IFRS 9. Those that supported fair value OCI as we propose do so for the reasons stated in the ED. And what I mean by that is that those users specifically told us that when financial assets are managed both for collection of contractual cash flows and for sale, that both amortized cost and fair value information are relevant. Moving on to the second group of respondents, the people who agreed with fair value OCI but proposed variations did that for different reasons, and they suggested a variety of different alternatives. There wasn't really a single alternative that was put forward by a large group of users, but there were a couple of common themes. In the survey responses, there were some people who distinguished between simple debt investments and simple loans and receivables and tended to think that the debt investments should be fair value OCI, whereas the loans and receivables should be amortized cost. There were also some who supported fair value OCI but didn't support basically measuring any financial assets at amortized cost. Similarly, a few outreach participants agreed with measuring some debt instruments at fair value OCI, but they felt very strongly that there should only be two measurement categories in IFRS 9. Some of them even stated that they didn't have a strong preference as to which two categories were in IFRS 9 as long as there were only two. Now moving on to the third group of respondents, who are those that disagreed with the proposals. Similarly, they also did it for different reasons and made different alternative suggestions. Some of the survey respondents suggested each of a few things. Some suggested that that financial assets would otherwise be measured at fair value OCI should be measured at amortized cost, basically broader amortized cost than we have in IFRS 9 today. There were those who suggested that those financial assets should be fair value PL, basically IFRS 9 2010 as it is today without the proposals. And then there was another group who supported measuring basically all financial assets at fair value through P&L. So another thing is that even those who disagreed in the comment letters and the user outreach didn't really object to the fair value through OCI, the hold to collect and for sale business model per se, but they generally tended to think that that having three measurement categories was more complex than having two. And they thought that having just two measurement categories would be superior just because it was fewer. A few also noted that they agreed with an aspect of the alternative view being that amortized cost or fair value information should be provided consistently in the financial statements. In other words, both in profit or loss and in the statement of financial position. The feedback we received from insurance analysts was broadly similar to that I just summarized. Again, a majority of the insurance analysts supported fair value OCI, and their feedback fell into three broad groups, being that slightly over half supported fair value OCI as proposed, nearly half supported fair value OCI with a variation, and then just a few didn't support fair value OCI at all. So you see broadly similar, but a bit more support for fair value OCI in some shape or form. In addition, most insurance analysts thought that the combination of the fair value OCI measurement category we proposed with the proposals in the insurance project to present changes in discount rate and in OCI would together provide useful information. And another point to mention, I suppose, on the insurance analyst feedback is that most insurance analysts, irrespective of their other views or preferences, did agree with the objective of reducing the mismatch between the accounting for financial assets and the insurance contracts liabilities. And Shaw will go through joint outreach in more detail, but it's worth mentioning that at a high level, the key messages that we heard in the joint outreach were consistent between our ISB-only outreach and the joint outreach as well. I suppose one final thing to quickly mention before opening up the floor for discussion is that most users who mentioned the own credit issue did support the ISB's proposal to allow early application of just own credits, and some of them actually also asked that these requirements be available in IS 39 and or be available as quickly as possible. So I guess very quickly before opening up the floor for discussion, at 20,000 feet, most users supported fair value OCI in some form or another, and there was no other suggestion from them that was as prevalent as what we proposed in the ED. So with that, happy to take comments and questions.
We're discussing here before Shah does his...
Yes.
Okay. Any comments? I suppose it didn't contain too many surprises.
I just one question. I note in the paper that there are some users, I don't know how many, who support putting everything at fair value P&L, including loans, debt instruments, all financial assets at fair value P&L. Where do they come from, those people?
Where do we find them?
Do you want your phone number? CFA.
That's been consistent through the project. I think there are at least
some people. I mean, some
analysts think fair value through P&L is appropriate for all.
Okay, are there the same people we know about forever?
Yes, I think so.
No new supporters. I mean,
the usual suspects.
I don't think anything
consistent. Consistent attitude.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Stephen.
So some of the insurance analysts have said this, particularly those in the UK. The insurance cruffers, some of them have said that. I was going to ask a different question, though. So you say that the insurance analysts agree with the objective of reducing the mismatches. Of course, the combined effect of our proposals will still result in mismatches being there. So was any concern expressed about the remaining mismatches, or are they just really pleased that at least it's better than existing accounting? And secondly, you said that some had suggested alternatives. Were any of those alternatives focused on further reducing the mismatches? And if so, what were they?
Okay, so I guess starting with your first question, yes, there were some people who who commented on the remaining mismatches, and they it was a common theme that people thought it was at least better than accounting today in many cases, and would it be a sufficient improvement? And there was some variety in views as to whether how much matching people wanted. So some people wanted really quite a lot of matching between financial assets and insurance contracts liabilities, whereas others, you know, wanted maybe less matching or only economic matching, or they, you know, just thought that a better match was enough.
Why would anybody want an accounting mismatch?
Well, I don't think people want accounting mismatch, but people disagree as to what accounting mismatch is versus economic mismatch, I think.
And I guess if I can just say that people are aware that what we have today is a different measurement for financial assets. And we have just one insurance liabilities. And I think they are kind of aware that it will be very difficult in the current environment to reduce all of the accounting mismatches. So I think with our proposals, they were focusing that for the simpler kind of financial instruments, when we are collecting cash flows, and for financial and for insurance contracts, where actually we just promised the death benefits, we just fixed the death benefits. They were comfortable that at least for those simpler contracts, we would have matched position. I think they were aware of the fact that some other contracts we would have mismatches, but they were happy. Some of them felt that what we are introducing is eliminating some of the mismatches that are today, and they thought that it might be a sufficient improvement.
So maybe if I could just add on to that, Steve, because I can see the look on your face, but I think that the main thing that we were testing with the insurance analysts was probably if this fair value through OCI is describing a business model which we think is consistent with the way that we understand many insurance companies manage their assets, assuming they had vanilla debt investments in that business model, is it a good thing that there's a match between the OCI proposals that are coming out in insurance with that type of business model? And then there was an acknowledgement, or hopefully we made them aware that that won't mean that all of their assets are going to be measured that way. And I think the tricky thing probably for us, both in our classification and measurement outreach, but also in the insurance outreach coming up, is going to be obviously that the extent to which it does or doesn't achieve a match is going to depend very much on the particular entity and its mix of assets that it holds. And so it's just something we're going to have to test as we go along. But I think in concept, having the ability to at least reflect that type of business model, knowing that there's these OCI proposals with insurance, was seen as a positive step.
Yes, and also I can add some of the users felt that amortized cost would be good information. Some of them said that fair value is a good information for those types of contracts. And I think what they appreciated is both information available from the asset and the liability side. So whichever way they are coming from or where they are coming from, both information is available for them and they can use it in a way that they find appropriate for those kinds of contracts.
PK.
Catherine, thank you for the summary. You know, when I read this paper, I just don't know what to do with this. The reason is that other than para 13, which says that, yeah, we all agree there should be a mandatory fair value through OCI, then when you go into the little bit more depth, you see they're as split as you can get, one-third, one-third, one-third. So I don't know how much comfort we need to take from this and what do we need to do with this. That's just an observation. That
it just means we have to show leadership.
Which we have. The other point I want to make is that, see, this last item that you have in your paper, para 38 on convergence, in fact, Shahid's paper that he's going to talk also emphasizes the need for convergence. In fact, Shahid's paper goes to the extent of saying that we want word and words to be the same between IFRS and US GAAP. I was curious, the often cited example that you have mentioned in the para 38 is only about equity instruments to be recycled or keep it in OCI, similar to what US GAAP is proposing. I was very curious why the own credit has not been brought up as a item that needs to be in convergence. Do you know any reason for that? Or is it own credit is so few, is going to be used so
well
by so many, so less people, they didn't really bother that much?
Well, I think, first of all,
they mean analysts.
See that we are closer together on that to begin with in what the FASB have proposed and what we have proposed.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I thought the own credit for the FASB recycles, and for us it doesn't recycle. So I think that's a big difference there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same thing with equity instruments. That equity instruments for us don't recycle, for the so-called strategic, and for them it recycles. First of all, it doesn't even go through OCI for them.
Yeah, I don't think that necessarily commented in that level of detail. So I think that's probably why.
And maybe if I could just quickly add that, as Catherine already stated, the entire user outreach was very much focused on the proposed introduction of fair value OCI. So generally, we didn't have that many comments on areas outside of fair value OCI. But we did have a couple of instances where recycling versus non-recycling of own credit was also raised as the difference between our and FASB's proposals.
Martin?
Yeah, one question, man. You mentioned that most of the users supporting the fair value OCI category, and that was even more pronounced by users who covering insurance companies. Was it different from users which cover banks and financial institutions? Did they also like it, most of them, more than not, or was there any?
Well, I mean, most supported it in general. So, yes, the same theme.
So no different picture if you look at that screen, right?
Yeah, the same question as Martin said.
Okay.
Because, you know, insurance analysts might be companies are a little biased toward the fair value OCI. So to get a more precise survey result, you should exclude the insurance companies in making some conclusion about their survey result. That's Martin is asking the same point. So if we, in the case of we include the insurance companies, we get that some kind of result. Or we can exclude all insurance companies' opinion. Then we can have another result. So basically, if the fair value OCI model is good in that model, then we have to get a good result from all survey results in both cases. But otherwise, we'll have some kind of a problem, you know, if fair value OCI model might not be, you know, accepted well enough.
I think that even if we took out insurance analysts, then only a minority would have only wanted two categories for classification and measurements, I think the same answer came through.
Yes, okay.
Okay. No more questions, answers. Over to you, Leslie.
Okay, thank you. Let me start by asking, are there any comments or questions on the ISB's investor group reach panel?
Yeah. Catherine, I very much appreciated your paragraph 15 in the box that you have breaking down all the users. But like PK, when I saw the, in effect, one-third, 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 it forced me to go look more carefully at your Appendix A and ask a few questions about the types of users. Could you answer a couple questions first? In your first user feedback by type, you make a distinction between asset managers and buy side. What's the distinction between those two that you're drawing?
That was in the survey. That was the way the survey was set up. So I think, generally speaking, buy side is a broader term than asset manager.
Okay, so you're not really drawing a distinction there between the two? Okay, I can add those two together. Did you also make a split between debt and equity? When I see this type of distribution, what I'm going to call a relatively even distribution, I wonder if there are patterns that we should be looking at, and, you know, would debt be leaning one direction versus equity another? Would sell side versus buy side? Would there be some distinctions there?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, the debt investors are picked up in the credit rating agencies and the creditor lender agencies. Certainly, that's the way we characterize our outreach. And I think, equity would be the sell side and most of the
assets. You can have debt and equity on sell side. You can have debt and equity on sell side and buy side. So I was wondering if you ran these charts, you know, what would it look like? Just a question, we can take this offline. But like PK, when I looked at the results, I was wondering why we had such an even distribution. And to a certain extent, it may be because of the debt and equity mix that you have in here. But it may also be because of the differences in regions. What I've noticed over the years is that European analysts can take a different approach than North American analysts, who may take a third approach from the global global and multiple, I guess is the way you characterized it. So I was curious as to whether there were any leanings one direction or the other. I think you did a good job from the insurance perspective, but I think there are other ways to slice this. And if you can share that data with our staff, maybe we can look at it in a little bit more detail.
Any other comments or questions?
Thanks, Catherine. I think I would just want to build on kind of what Hal was saying. Did you get a sense from the different user types that you talked to, what were the metrics that they were focused on in their analysis? It just seems to me that depending on which kind of user it is, and where they might be, if you understand what the metrics are that they're using for the analysis, you might get a better sense of why they feel the way that they feel about the particular measurement and classification. If they're focused mainly on capital versus net interest income versus net income, you know, you might get different answers. The capital requirements, I understand, are starting to think about incorporating OCI into their capital requirements. So maybe it's, if they're talking about volatility, maybe it's not capital, maybe it's volatility in net income. But do you have a sense for those kinds of things? And I understand that insurance could be even different from that.
Well, I think most of the users we spoke to were happy with the information being available and happy to also make adjustments if they thought that would be appropriate in a particular case. So they weren't concerned that necessarily, for example, volatility would be hitting capital. If they wanted to back it out, they'd be happy to back it out. They did like seeing the stable generally the stable interest income, because then they view that as a predictable cash flow. They didn't say necessarily that they only focus on one or the other. They liked having both, I think.
I'd just like to share an observation. While Some are characterizing a great diversity of beliefs in paragraph 15 of Model 6A. I think if we were to do the same sort of graph on Memo 6B about the percentage of people that just supported the proposal versus those that supported it with suggested changes versus those that disagreed about any one of the proposals in here, we get a similar mix. So I'm not overreacting to the diversity of opinion that's in paragraphs 15 of Memo 6A.
Great. Why don't we turn to Shahid, who's going to review paper 6B.
All right. Thank you, Leslie. Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon, IASB. Now we will discuss FASB Memo 231, IASB Agenda Reference 6B, which summarizes the feedback received by on the FASB's classification and measurement exposure graph issued in February 2013. Just a quick note for our audience and for all those are listening in. The summary that the board will discuss today is available on the FASB's project webpage as well as on the ISB's website. The comment period on both the February 2013 and the April 2013 consequential amendments updates ended on May 15. To date, the FASB has received 148 comment letters on the February 2013 exposure draft, and around 15 comment letters on the consequential amendments exposure draft. Although I should add, the consequential amendments feedback received was also included as part of the feedback received on the main February 2013 doc. In addition, during the comment period, the FASB staff conducted outreach meeting with well over 40 stakeholders comprising preparers, users, auditors, and regulators. These meetings were attended by the FASB board members as well as ISB staff. The feedback we will discuss today is summarized mostly in the order specified in paragraph 3 of the memo. First, I will discuss the feedback on the objective and the recognition topics, and then Sarah will tee up the feedback on scope and the remaining topics. In regards to the objective of the proposed update, respondents, both users and non-users, supported the key objectives of reducing complexity, providing decisionally useful information to users, and convergence in accounting financial instruments. Although many users and non-user respondents supported classifying financial assets on the basis of the instrument's cash flow characteristics and the business model for managing these instruments, many non-user respondents did not believe that the proposed update achieved the board's objective of reducing complexity and providing decisionally useful information, mostly due to the potential consequences of applying the cash flow test and the restrictiveness of the business model application guidance. Those non-user respondents believe that the SPPI, or the solely payments of principal and interest test, swapped complexity from the current complex rules-based bifurcation guidance to a new test. Therefore, these non-user respondents recommended that the board retain the current embedded bifurcation requirements in Topic 815 for financial assets, which will also help achieve symmetry in the accounting with financial liabilities. However, these respondents noted that if the SPPI test is retained, then the board should make the test less complex and resolve unintended consequences associated with applying the cash flow test. Users that responded to the proposed update and that participated in outreach meetings with the staff supported the cash flow and business model-based classification and noted that the proposed update creates a single, comprehensive model for measuring financial assets and is a significant step towards simplifying and improving quality of financial reporting. However, these users also highlighted concerns and improvements to the business model test. Detailed feedback on the objective topic is discussed in paragraphs 4 through 7 of the memo. I will now tee up the cash flow and then I will pause to take any questions from the board. In regards to the cash flow characteristics or the SPPI test, many respondents raised questions and concerns which are summarized in 10 broad categories as outlined in paragraph 18 of the memo and discussed in paragraphs 19 through 31. I will touch upon just a few key points. In regards to de minimis features, non-user respondents noted that many instruments have features that are expected to be triggered in unusual circumstances and that such features do not cause a concern under current GAAP because they are either considered clearly and closely related or are immaterial if bifurcation is required. These respondents were concerned that the SPPI test narrowly focuses on specific interest rate reset and leverage features, and as a result, many instruments could fail the SPPI test. Therefore, these respondents noted that they do not believe that features unrelated to interest resets, leverage, or credit that are likely to have a small effect or are unlikely to arise in the future should drive the classification outcome. Many respondents also expressed concern regarding what they perceive to be an unintended consequence of the SPPI test. These respondents noted that many debt instruments acquired at a significant discount or premium that contain a prepayment option could fail the SPPI test. These respondents noted that, for example, purchase credit impaired loans have terms that require prepayment par amount, and given the prepayment option guidance, such instruments could fail the SPPI test and result in fair value net income classification. And these respondents questioned whether that was the board's intended outcome for PCI or similar instruments for which the board has developed a comprehensive impairment model. Respondents also expressed concern regarding the modified economic relationship test. These respondents were concerned that the low threshold was too restrictive and questioned the basis for permitting only certain features that do not cause more than insignificant variability in cash flows to pass the test. These respondents noted that it was very common for instruments issued in the United States to either A, reset, or B, be based on rates, for example, the prime rate or an average rate for a specified period, or where the rate may adjust subsequently to reflect changes in the central bank's reserve requirements. These respondents noted that given the low, more than insignificant threshold and the restrictive nature of the modified economic relationship test, such very common terms or provisions may cause many basic loan products, for example, adjustable rate mortgages, to fail the SPPI test, which they noted was again an unintended consequence of the model. These respondents requested that the board clarify the objective of the modified economic relationship test and address basic provisions and common terms to many loan products and whether such instruments should be measured at something other than fair value net income. Respondents also expressed concern regarding the inconsistency in the consideration of probability of outcomes in applying the SPPI test, the guidance related to contingent and other prepayment features. That feedback is discussed in paragraphs 28 through 32. Respondents also expressed concern and disagreement with the look-through guidance for beneficial interests. These respondents noted that the resource-intensive requirements to assess the assets in the trust would not result in better accounting than current GAAP, and in certain types of structures, the level of information needed to perform the analysis may not be available. Many respondents also expressed significant concern and disagreement with credit tests required for beneficial interest in securitized financial assets. These respondents noted that assessing the credit risk for beneficial interest would be inconsistent with the SPPI principle and would result in many subordinated tranches failing to qualify for amortized cost or fair value OCI classification. These respondents noted that the credit test would also result in counterintuitive classification for investment deferring credit quality. Comments on the beneficial interest guidance is in paragraphs 33 to 38. Finally, respondents also requested clarification regarding application of the SPPI test to certain common instruments, for example, credit card receivables with below-market introductory rates that reset to higher rates in the future, auction rate securities, revenue bonds, loan participations, and so forth. So that was just a quick summary of the objective and the capital. I will pause here and see if the board has any questions or comments.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, folks? Daryl?
Sure, I wanted to ask a question about short-term payables and receivables that I think some respondents indicated that they thought that it should be sort of carved out and not be subject to applying the classification model. And I think that, if I remember right, that's because they would say that those should be carried at amortized costs, and they were worried that by applying the model, some of them would fail some of the classification tests. Can you think of, you know, some specifics in terms of what specifically they were worried about them failing within the test? And if those factors are present, then shouldn't they potentially be classified as something other than amortized costs?
So So there, I think to your point, some of the questions were arising from the way the definition was involved, because it talked about the amount versus, you know, goods and services exchange. So some respondents commented on clarifying whether, you know, your typical receivables payables are in scope. Do they meet that definition? And clearly that was the alcohol. That's what we meant, and so that's a clarification. I think for very basic trade receivables, payables, at least talking from the receivable side, because payables won't be subject to the asset side of the guidance. I think, you know, it has been the staff thinking as we worked through it last year through the model, these typical, you know, plain vanilla receivables will be at cost. I mean, we'll pass the definition of P&I, so we didn't see any significant consequence of applying the model to trade receivables.
Okay.
Okay.
This is the part of the response that was most surprising to me, because I thought most of the focus would be on the business model rather than on the cash flow characteristics of the solely principal and interest. And I didn't anticipate the degree of concerns that would come out of this. I'm one that have never liked the literature that we provided in the United States and clearly in closer related. But in reading these comments and the commenters' responses, I've grown to understand why it became as complicated as it is at this point in time. And it seems to me that to respond to these comments, we may be building a very similar model with perhaps as many complications under solely principal and interest as we have under clearly and closely related, if we really do want to keep certain instruments eligible for other than fair value net income treatment. So it causes me pause as to whether we'll be building another very significant mousetrap while retaining the clearly and closely related on the liability side and therefore having two complicated literatures. But I think we have to take on that challenge. The other thing that I thought, in particular, I was convinced about this de minimis feature sort of things that are benign in the clearly and closely related literature, because they are clearly and closely related, and you don't have to think about magnitudes in those areas in the same way that we are in solely principal and interest. But the other and final area that I was maybe not surprised about, but I think it's going to be a challenge for us, is this issue of looking through to beneficial interests. I think there are some very really significant issues raised about the ability to do that and to do it effectively, at least in our comment letters. And I think if we're going to end up with a converged solution to this problem, we really have to have the screen to get into the business model result in the same outcomes and be able to be done effectively. So I'm really curious, I don't recall whether the same range of issues came up in the comment letters from the IASB, so I'd like to get a reaction as to are we talking about the same set of issues that we've got to be dealing with, including looking through to beneficial interests, or not?
I think from our side, specifically on the question of the beneficial interests, it wasn't in the scope of our limited improvements exposure draft, so we weren't planning to re-deliberate the look-through requirements, but rather to focus on the more general overarching principal and interest criteria and trying to work with you there to get outcomes that were more attuned with what people thought were appropriate, simple principal and interest outcomes.
Sue, I appreciate that. Are you aware of any practice issues that have emerged in trying to apply the guidance? Because
okay.
I guess I find it curious that we're getting this feedback and we were converging to your guidance in this area.
Okay, sorry, I misunderstood your question. In terms of the feedback that we've had since the model was developed, we've had a couple of specific questions on it, which we tried to address in the document to do with, for example, if you ended up with physical security in the portfolio example, for example, what would you do about that? So we've had a couple of very specific questions on it. But as a general proposal, we haven't really had many concerns at all raised on the contractually linked criteria. And I think that at least in part reflects the fact that actually the contractually linked criteria that we have in IFRS 9 came very much from a very close working relationship we had with a group of the banks on our side. And so it was actually developed with industry here. So I'm not sure whether it's because of differences in the structure of instruments in between the two different markets, and also perhaps partly because we started with different GAAP. And maybe that's part of the difference as well.
That's surprising to me in some respects, because I was really convinced by our comment letters about the difficulty of being able to do this effectively, and the challenges of going forward and applying it, and the issue that it really is sort of a different objective or a different way of thinking about classification. So I hope that we at least could consider whether we can talk about that jointly or not.
That was actually the exact same observation on the beneficial, on the look-through provisions. Because if I remember right, in the ISB, when you originally did your original ED that led to IFRS 9, there wasn't a look-through provision because of the fear that it was inoperable, because it was difficult to operationalize. The fact was that you could do it, and then put it into IFRS 9. And so I was sort of surprised when I saw the concern flags raised up here. As to why it would be so difficult here compared to what you heard when you deliberated nine, so it's pretty much the same observation.
Yeah, I think history comes into it as well, though, I think, because in our original ED that preceded IFRS 9, our original proposal was, you were right, that there was no look-through, but our original proposal was that only the most senior tranche of any securitization structure would ever be eligible for amortized cost.
Yes.
And I think relative to that, people were willing to put in the effort to do the look-through. So I think the history matters.
That's all.
Okay, let me turn it back to Shahid.
Sorry, just quick question/vision. In the disclosure section, as I look through this, I was looking in particular for user feedback on the disclosures. I read this as lukewarm support from when we say things like some respondents, including a user, agreed. Several other places you say many respondents other than users disagreed. We never seem to see ever say whether there was actual user support for the disclosures.
Yeah, we'll get to the disclosures later. But
oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought we were going to take the whole document. Sorry.
We're only at 39.
I'm so excited. Okay. My fault.
Do you mean disclosures about the cash flow test?
I'll save my comments. Corrected.
Okay. All right. I should ask, are there any comments or questions at the IASB through paragraph 39?
They go?
What Sue just said, exactly what I want to say, our original ED didn't propose look through. But people say that it will be counterintuitive if the underlies, let's assume, subject to amortized cost. And my question is, I may have forgotten, whether our current requirement require you must look through, or if you can, you. Now this is if we require you must go look through, and then the people say, how can I do if I cannot? If the requirement is,
I think you default to fair value under our standard. If you cannot look through, you default to fair value.
You default to fair value through P&L.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Can I just say something, though? I think this look through, when I read these comments, especially in paragraph 35, 36, I think some excellent points were made by the respondents to the comment letter, and I'm really surprised why we are not seeing that. Granted, IFRS 9 is not as widely as applied as of now, but I would be surprised why those questions don't come up in our constituency or to the IFRS users. And I think it begs the question that perhaps we need to think through why those should not be there. Because if you look at the one really struck me is that some vehicles will end up owning assets, not that they want to own, but they'll own up. What do you do in those situations? I think those are all fair questions to ask, and I think we need to think through when we are deliberating whether there's any need for expansion or do something else. Because I don't want to be in a situation where U.S. does it and we don't do it, and that becomes a default gap.
other comments?
Moving on to business model assessment, users consistently agreed with classification and measurement based on the business model objectives, while many respondents other than users also agreed that a business model-driven classification best reflects how an entity manages a business and how an entity expects to drive cash flows from those instruments. However, most respondents, including users, expressed concern about the restrictive nature of the amortized cost business model because of the types of sales permitted from this classification category. The staff has summarized the feedback on the business model assessment into six categories that outlined in paragraph 40, discussed in paragraphs 40 through 58. A few key points. Many respondents expressed concern about the clarity around the fair value OCI business model, although many respondents, including users, supported the three classification categories. These respondents noted that either end of the spectrum of hold to collect and held for sale, that is amortized cost and fair value net income, were easy to discern in practice, whereas defining the middle category, that is fair value OCI, required significant judgment. These respondents proposed having fair value OCI as a residual category rather than fair value net income. Some respondents also stated that the primary or sole criterion for determining classification and measurement for financial assets should be an entity's business model. These respondents noted that if financial assets were only subject to the business model assessment and not the cash flow, equity instruments not held for trading would be eligible for fair value OCI measurement, and thus reflected on the balance sheet in a way that reflects the longer-term nature of the holding period and thereby limiting earnings volatility. Similar to these respondents, some users and several respondents, including insurers, smaller financial institutions, and non-financial preparers, strongly supported allowing equity investments to be measured at fair value OCI. These respondents stated that recognizing changes in fair value net income would result in significant earnings volatility and would create a disincentive to invest in equity securities. In contrast, several users who participated in outreach meetings and some non-user respondents, including Professional Accounting Society, strongly agreed with the proposed update to classify equity investments at fair value net income. These respondents noted that recognizing changes in net income would be more transparent and relevant. Several respondents also requested that the board clarify the level at which the business model should be assessed. These respondents noted that they believe the board intended the assessment to be performed at portfolio level rather than at a segment or a higher level. In regards to amortized cost business model, majority of respondents noted significant concerns about the restricted nature of the sales guidance. A large number of respondents cited the fundamental business consideration of allowing sales to broad credit risk management for business models that are still consistent with the notion of hold to collect. A majority of these respondents cited the need to be able to sell because of concentrations of credit risk, such as managing portfolio risk in terms of geography or line of business, and still qualify for the hold-to-collect business model. Additionally, some respondents noted that sales may be necessary due to a violation of a legal lending requirement or entity limits, which are fluid as economic conditions changes. Furthermore, both preparers and users consistently noted that sales, because of concentrations of credit risk and from an expected significant deterioration in credit of the counterparty, should be permitted in order to make sound business decisions. And finally, majority of the respondents supported excluding an explicit tainting notion from the proposed guidance, although many acknowledged that given the restrictiveness of the sales guidance, there is an implicit tainting notion in the model. With that, I'll stop here and see if the board have any questions on the business model.
Mark,
So the feedback that we got on the business model was, to me, a little bit frustrating in that the principle for the amortized cost category, for example, of hold to collect, right? People supported generally the idea that we should have a principle of hold to collect and then spend pages in the comment letters talking about all the times they don't hold to collect. And so I'm worrying that this is going to be an area that there's going to be an insatiable desire for additional guidance over and over and over again. And I just, again, fear that all this really convinced me of what I believed in the alternative view, which was an activity-based model dealing with not with management intent at the end of the instrument, but how the instrument originated might be more effective than this. But and the equity instruments as well was an area where I was not convinced that we need to have a fair value OCI category. Again, it goes back to what are the metrics that are being focused on that might drive why you might think that way. And Zhao was very careful to point that it was really only earnings volatility, that people were focused on when they were thinking about that. The principles that we had all would point to the only possible category being fair value net income equity securities. And so I couldn't find any reason to move off of it. So just an observation.
Thank you. Other comments?
Well, I agree with everything Mark said, but I also am concerned about the strong push to say I can sell a lot of the amortized cost bucket due to credit deterioration. Now, I understand that there might be some de minimis sales to manage, credit concentration, pardon me, not credit deterioration, that there may be some de minimis sales or small portions of sales that are natural due to credit concentration, but opening up any sale due to credit concentration as being viable basically says you can sell out of the amortized cost bucket at any time, because any sale would change the credit concentration characteristics. So I'm very concerned about being overly responsive if that's the approach we take to opening up permissible sales by increasing the number of reasons for the sales is opening up the ability to sell at any time.
Hans, would you like to see if there are any questions or comments?
Okay. Any questions here? No, not the case. No questions here. Oh,
the question, here? Just an overall impression I get is that there is a lot of consistency in the responses to the ISB and the FASB proposed update on the attitude towards volatility in earnings. I think the attitude in the U.S. seems to be pretty much closer to our respondents than I felt initially. Supporting OCI for equity instruments, supporting more flexibility or maybe a wider approach to the solely P&I test for classification amortization. All that is very, very consistent with our respondents, which comes as a surprise to me.
Or perhaps not. The flesh is weak on both sides of the Atlantic. Chen Wu.
One question on the paragraph 45. Maybe, I don't know, but this is not I'm not asking formal response from the staff, but just I'd like to know the maybe staff's personal opinion about whether equity instrument can be classified as a fair value OCI, as suggested in paragraph 45.
Yeah, I think some of the feedback was to provide a similar option, similar to IFRS 9 for equity securities for a fair value OCI option. But I think majority of the respondents in here in the U.S. supported recycling if such an option was provided.
And just to be clear, the majority of investors that we spoke with here supported fair value net income for equity instruments.
Okay. Any other comments on this section?
Okay. Moving on, most respondents generally agreed with the scope of the proposed update. Some respondents recommended that the board continue to consider the interaction between the scope of the proposed update and the scope of the project on insurance contracts. And as Daryl noted, other respondents questioned the inclusion of short-term receivables and payables in the scope. Most respondents also agreed with the industry-specific specialized guidance scope exceptions. However, some respondents proposed that all financial assets and financial liabilities of an investment company subject to Topic 946 be explicitly excluded rather than only the initial and subsequent measurement of investments in debt and equity securities held by investment companies. Feedback on scope is discussed further in paragraphs 8 through 17 of the memo. Most respondents agreed with the initial measurement principles for financial instruments in the proposed update. Many respondents requested clarification and additional application guidance about the proposed guidance regarding when the transaction price includes consideration for something other than the financial instrument. Feedback on initial measurement is discussed further in paragraph 62 through 66 of the memo. With that, I'm going to ask, does the board have any questions or comments on the feedback received on scope and initial measurement?
Anything on the
Okay, moving on to subsequent measurement, I will highlight feedback on the fair value option, financial liabilities, equity investments without readily determinable fair values, deferred tax assets, and business model reclassifications. The memo also addresses the feedback received on the portfolio-wide fair value option for not-for-profit entities and measurement of financial assets subsequently identified for sale. Regarding the fair value option, users and some non-user respondents strongly supported limiting the fair value option, citing improved comparability and more decision-useful information. Many non-user respondents advocated for the retention of an unconditional fair value through net income option. Several other respondents, even those in favor of restricting the fair value option, also recommended providing a fair value option to eliminate or reduce an accounting mismatch as provided in IFRS 9. Several non-user respondents expressed support for providing a fair value option for instruments that qualify for the fair value through other comprehensive income category. These respondents noted that it would allow better matching of assets and liabilities and also better reflect an entity's business model. Most respondents generally disagreed with eliminating the fair value option in current U.S. GAAP for financial instruments excluded from the scope of the February 2013 proposed update. For classification and measurement of financial liabilities, most respondents strongly agreed with the subsequent measurement of financial liabilities at amortized cost, unless certain exceptions are met. Most respondents also agreed with the requirement that a non-recourse financial liability settled with cash flows from related financial assets be measured on the same basis as those assets. Some of these respondents noted that the board should consider defining non-recourse and clarify in the final update that non-financial assets that are held temporarily would not disqualify an entity from using the non-recourse financial liability guidance. One respondent also noted that in certain situations, the fair value of the financial liability will be more observable than that of the financial asset, and therefore, in these situations, the measurement of the financial asset should follow the measurement of the financial liability. On the topic of bifurcation, in most cases, respondents' comments on the proposed amendments that provide an asymmetrical model for hybrid financial assets and hybrid financial liabilities were influenced by their views on the cash flow characteristics assessment. The few users who commented on bifurcation agreed with eliminating bifurcation for hybrid financial assets. Many non-user respondents did not support eliminating bifurcation for hybrid financial assets due to concerns highlighted in the cash flow characteristics section of the feedback summary. These respondents also preferred the symmetry achieved by retaining bifurcation for both hybrid financial assets and hybrid financial liabilities, and were concerned about the complexity of two different approaches, solely payments of principal and interest, and clearly and closely related bifurcation guidance. Regarding equity investments without readily determinable fair values, most respondents agreed with providing a practicability exception for their measurement. Respondents who agreed with the practicability exception noted that it would reduce operational complexity and be an improvement over the cost method. However, a few respondents requested further clarification of what constitutes a similar investment of the same issuer and how much effort a preparer would be required to undertake to find observable changes in price. Respondents were evenly divided regarding the requirement for an entity to evaluate the need for a valuation allowance on a deferred tax asset related to a debt instrument measured at fair value through other comprehensive income separately from other deferred tax assets of the entity rather than combined and analyzed together. Finally, many respondents agreed with the requirement to reclassify financial assets when a change in business model occurs and with the subsequent accounting for such reclassifications. These respondents noted that the reclassification of financial assets when the business model changes ensures that the classification reflects an entity's new business model. Several respondents commented specifically on the date of reclassification and agreed with the proposed guidance that financial assets should be reclassified on the last day of the reporting period in which a change in business model occurs. A detailed summary of the comments received on subsequent measurement is included in paragraphs 67 through 103 of the memo. With that, I'll turn it over to the board for any questions and comments on subsequent measurement.
Thank you. Comments
or one of the objectives of this project is to reduce the complexity in the reporting for financial instruments. I'll tell you, when I was reading this memo last night, I was having a hard time keeping track of all the choices myself. And perhaps I have some expertise in the area. Some may disagree about that. But I can't really fathom at times how users sort through all this. We end up having many requests here to say, and assertions to say, we really do hold a collect. But then I want a lot of options to be able to sell out of the hold to collect. We've got three different methods on the asset side, two different methods on the liability side. We end up having whole assets with embedded derivatives treated one way on the asset side, differently on the liability side, and then a request to override all this with a fair value option whenever we want to. And it starts feeling very much like the whole guidance is a series of constrained options. And I think, like Hans says, we ought to be able to be taking leadership in this area to try to reduce some of this complexity and not end up with accounting for financial instruments being five or six or seven different methods for financial instruments on the assets and liability side that are all constrained options.
Thank you. Any other? Hans, anything over there?
I'm looking around. No, I don't think so.
Okay. Next up, presentation.
Right. Respondents also commented on topics related to presentation and disclosure of financial assets and financial liabilities. Users who commented on the proposed update and who participated in outreach meetings with the staff strongly support the requirement for public entities to parenthetically present fair value information for items measured at amortized cost on the face of the statement of financial position. Several non-user respondents also support this requirement. One user in support of this requirement recommended that it be extended to non-public entities. Most non-user respondents disagreed with the requirement to parenthetically present fair value information. These respondents noted that this requirement would clutter the face of the statement of financial position and could potentially confuse users. Respondents, including users, strongly support the requirement for an entity to separately present changes in fair value attributable to changes in entity-specific credit risk in other comprehensive income for financial liabilities for which that entity has elected the fair value option. Respondents noted that this requirement would help to resolve concerns about how unrealized gains and losses attributable to changes in an entity's own credit risk for financial liabilities designated under the fair value option affect financial performance. Some respondents also recommended that this presentation requirement be expanded to include financial liabilities that are measured at fair value for which an entity has not elected the fair value option, such as derivative liabilities. Most respondents agreed with the proposed requirement that an entity separately recognize in net income changes in fair value attributable to foreign currency gain or loss on foreign currency denominated debt securities measured at fair value through other comprehensive income. Respondents had mixed views regarding the method to compute the foreign currency gain or loss component to be recognized in net income. Many respondents preferred the use of an amortized cost-based method as compared to the fair value-based method, while some recommended that an entity should be able to elect either method. Regarding disclosures, many non-user respondents disagreed with the proposed disclosure requirements about fair value information for financial instruments measured at amortized cost because these disclosures would be operationally burdensome. Several respondents, including a few users, generally agreed with the proposed disclosure requirements related to core deposit liabilities. However, most respondents, including a user, disagreed with these proposed disclosure requirements, noting that these disclosures would be internally generated, highly judgmental, and would include proprietary information. Finally, several respondents requested that interim disclosures not be required unless a significant change has occurred from annual disclosures. Feedback on the presentation disclosure requirements is further discussed in paragraphs 104 through 121 of the memo. Does the board have any questions or comments on feedback received on presentation disclosure?
Okay, so does Hal need to repeat the
question? I'm going to restate it, but in a slightly different way. There seems to be a disconnect between Section 6 on presentation and Section 7 on disclosure. Section 6, paragraph 104, I think it was, strongly supports the parenthetical disclosure of fair value. But when you read disclosures section in isolation, it suggests that there was not a lot of support for anything beyond parenthetical disclosure of fair value, except for maybe core deposits, because you use comments like a user or a few users. So am I reading that incorrectly?
And Shani, correct me wrong. I mean, I think the issue with disclosures was, I think people, users aren't seeing a whole lot of difference in what they will get, right? I mean, they're not saying don't give us a disclosure. I think this is the feedback we're getting more is from non-users rather than from users on the disclosure, because I think non-users are viewing them as burdensome. So I think to your point, it's not a user issue regarding disclosures. Shani?
Yeah, no, I think users supported fair value for amortized costs.
That's clear from the parenthetical discussion. Right. Just curious.
In terms of core deposits, yeah, I think, you know, if you look back at the outreach we performed before, they actually wanted a lot more deposits, and, you know, we've worked through that, and this is where we've landed, and I think that they think this would be an improvement. This information would help us.
I was just putting this in the context of the work we're doing in the disclosure framework. And are we providing too much in the area of disclosures is a way to scale that back. But that's, I'm misreading that then. Okay.
Any other?
Yeah, just point of information. This is the user feedback in this section just based on comment letters, or is it inclusive of only?
Both.
Both, okay.
So we spoke to 14 users, I think 10. All right, hold on one second. 10 were equity analysts, 4 were fixed income or credit ratings analysts. The majority of the folks we spoke to were buy side, I think 8 of the 14. And then, as I said, a few were credit ratings agencies analysts, and then we had a few sell side folks as well.
To your point, 3 years ago we spoke to 114.
Right.
And that's feedback that you had it, right?
Yeah, Mark, to be honest, I mean, I think we've reached out to well over 50, 60 users, yeah. Right? And I think just the feedback we've seen on, you know, back from the 2010 document and throughout the outreach we've done, starting with redeliberations on the 2010 document, is just very consistent. It's, you know, some chose to respond to us via email or, you know, via calls, and the feedback's been fairly consistent. We haven't heard anything.
Right. No, I know there's been a ton of outreach, and that's why I was surprised, right. Maybe like Hal, to see like under a couple of users when I know that there's been dozens.
Yes.
And in regards to the core deposit intangible, it is pretty been uniform through their process to say that there is desire to understand the inputs to that measurement that they don't have, and it's vital to understanding the financial institutions to do that.
We've gotten, as you mentioned, some pushback from preparers on the parenthetical fair value disclosure on the face as far as the cluttering issue. Just curious, because I can remember from the memo, do users ever express a concern about the clutter?
No, actually, they prefer having that, because I think they think it will be more timely, it will be more rigor to the measurement that we're doing. That's what we've consistently heard from all users.
Okay, Hal.
Just a quick question on that. Parenthetically, fair value base for collectively all debt instruments. Detail in the back?
Yes.
Okay, I couldn't remember.
Hans, anything over there on presentation or disclosure?
Any remarks here? No, nothing. Thank you, Leslie.
Okay, thank you. Sarah, you going
to
continue?
Yes. Moving to the equity method of accounting. Some respondents agreed with the proposed requirements that equity method investments that are held for sale should be accounted for at fair value through net income, but expressed concern that the proposed held for sale indicators are too broad and would result in many equity method investments being considered held for sale. These respondents recommended that the board further clarify these indicators to avoid unintended consequences. In contrast, a majority of the respondents did not support the proposed change, and instead support the current guidance on the equity method of accounting, coupled with an unconditional fair value option. Respondents had mixed views on the one-step impairment approach for equity investments. Many supported the use of qualitative factors, but they expressed concern that the single-step impairment model would lead to recognition of impairment losses without a provision to reflect subsequent changes in the economics of these investments. Feedback on the equity method of accounting is further discussed in paragraphs 132 through 130 of the memo. For non-financial hybrid instruments, respondents generally supported the guidance related to these instruments on the basis that this guidance is symmetrical to the proposed accounting for hybrid financial instruments. Some respondents cited disagreement with the proposed guidance on non-financial hybrid assets on the same basis as their disagreement with the proposed updates amendments, which would require hybrid financial assets to be classified in their entirety at fair value through net income. These respondents preferred to retain the current bifurcation and separate accounting model, coupled with the ability to elect an unconditional fair value option for such instruments. Non-financial hybrid instruments are discussed in paragraphs 131 and 132 of the memo. With that, I'm going to stop and ask if the board has any questions on equity method or non-financial hybrid instruments.
Okay. Anything over there?
No comments here?
We'll move on to
No.
Moving on to consequential amendments. Respondents also provided feedback on the consequential amendments proposed in the April 2013 proposed update. Most respondents agreed that all guidance related to financial instruments in various topics in the codification should be consolidated into a single topic, whereas some respondents noted that the current structure separates the guidance by type of financial instrument, which makes understanding the scope and applicability of the guidance easier. Respondents also provided specific comments on various aspects of the consequential amendments to the codification, such as eligible hedge items. The staff will analyze and discuss this topic with the board prior to the issuance of a final standard. Feedback on consequential amendments is further discussed in paragraphs 141 through 144 of the memo. On the topic of transitions, respondents generally agreed with the transition provisions in the proposed update, but asked for additional transition guidance in some areas, such as for instruments that no longer qualify for the fair value option. Several respondents recommended that the reclassification guidance for financial assets reclassified from amortized cost to fair value net income be applicable as transitional guidance for all financial instruments, including equity method investments, for which an entity has elected the fair value option under current U.S. GAAP, but would no longer qualify for the fair value option under the proposed update. Most respondents, including users, agreed that an entity should be permitted to early adopt the proposed presentation requirements related to changes in instrument-specific credit risk for hybrid financial liabilities that are measured at fair value through net income by electing the fair value option. Regarding the effective date, respondents were generally divided about whether the effective date should be the same for both public and non-public entities, with a slight majority recommending a one-year deferral of the effective date for non-public entities. Many respondents requested that the effective date of this proposed update be aligned with the effective dates of the guidance on credit losses and insurance contracts. Finally, most respondents agreed that at least 2 to 3 years would be needed to implement the proposed guidance. Transition and effective date are further discussed in paragraphs 133 through 140 of the memo. With that, I'll turn it over to the board for discussion on the consequential amendments and transition.
Thank you. Anything? Is anything over there?
I don't think so. No.
Any additional comments from the staff?
No, I think the staff would just like to highlight the plan going forward. We plan to begin our redeliberations in July, jointly with the IASB, and the joint topics we will talk about special characteristics, business model, fair value option, and so forth. We plan on starting July with the paper on the cash flow characteristics to consider the feedback we received both by the ISB and by our constituents here in the U.S. And so I expect those the cash flow meetings to kind of be, you know, in July, and then another meeting probably in September to address the concerns we've raised. As well, we'll talk about the business model bifurcation in September, and any remaining topics that we may have may flow into October potentially. And then the FASB may we'll discuss its FASB specific goals in the second half of the year.
Any additional comments?
I want to recall that when users talked about moving to an amortized cost model for some financial instruments, their discussion of that was in regard to having fair value information available, and then also information available about the timing of cash flow payments related to financial instruments. Now, we dealt with that here preliminarily in what we called the liquidity disclosures. And I'm not sure that that's exactly what users thought they really wanted, was liquidity disclosures. They wanted to understand the timing of payments that are contractually required within financial instruments. And I would like us to at least consider when we move forward in the disclosure aspects of the project, if we're not going to continue separately with liquidity or interest rate risk, that we at least leave a marker to think about whether or not some sort of table that allows the users to better understand the timing of cash, contractual cash flow payments for financial instruments is something that we should embed in this project.
Or pursue as a separate work stream.
Yes.
Okay. Any additional comments? Hans, any additional comments over there?
No, thank you, Leslie.
Okay. With that, I would just like to say today is my last joint board meeting with the IASB. It has been 10 years of continuous efforts to try and improve and converge our standards, and I think we have made significant progress to both improve the standards and also bring them closer together. I want to say to the staff of the IASB and to the staff of the FASB, but you'll hear my full remarks next week, I just want to thank you for your professionalism, hard work, and commitment to working through what have been some pretty challenging issues. And to both the board and the staff, it's been an absolute pleasure working with you, and I wish you continued success in developing high-quality global standards. Thank you.
Leslie, I already bid you a more or less formal farewell at the first
yes.
and your last ASEF dinner. But, of course, I cannot let it go unnoticed here that this is your last our last joint meeting where you are the chair of the FASB. I really want to thank you for your leadership and the cooperation that you have shown in the last 2.5 years. These have been extremely interesting times, in a large part due to the financial crisis. And sometimes the times were indeed very difficult, and the boards were being pulled in different directions, and we sometimes hit a bumpy road. But we have been able, we are now finishing the four big standards that are the jewel on the crown of convergence. And on many issues, we have been able to come a lot closer together than many have thought possible. And indeed, the current project, the classification and measurement, is one example of that. And I really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your contribution to that, because your leadership indeed has been extremely, extremely helpful and important. I don't even think that you know what you're going to do, except for a well-earned rest and vacation. I wish you a fantastic summer, and I'm sure a lot of opportunities will come your way, and that you will succeed your career in an extremely successful manner. Thank you for everything.